TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Hoodwinked in the Hothouse. Leonardo Figueroa Gelin, Tom Goldtooth, and Ananda Tan. This is another webinar on Indigenous resistance to climate false solutions. This one was co-sponsored by the New School in New York City with the Indigenous Environmental Network as key organizer. The IEN was founded in 1990 within the United States. They are supporting Indigenous communities and tribal governments in the U.S. and abroad in protecting sacred sites, land, water, and air. Tom Goldtooth has served as executive director of the IEN since 1996. The New School is a private research university in New York City. Its original mission was to serve academic freedom, intellectual inquiry, and be a home for progressive thinkers. This New School-sponsored webinar took place during New York City Climate Week on September 21, 2021, in preparation of the Conference of Parties, the COP26 in Glasgow. As I'm recording this introduction on November 15, the fears and expectations expressed in this program about COP26 very sadly came true. But at least the false solutions were observed and opposed by the largest and most organized groups of Indigenous peoples in the history of the conferences of parties. Here's the Indigenous Environmental Network press release of November 13, 2021. Glasgow, Scotland. After 30 years of negotiations, the COP26 in Glasgow delivers a disastrous outcome. Governments will exit Glasgow with no chance of keeping global warming below 1.5°C. Tom Goldtooth, the executive director of the Indigenous Environmental Network, stated, quote, "The outcome of COP26 locks us into another decade of false solutions, colonialism and unbridled violence upon Mother Earth, full stop. The expansion of carbon markets, techno fixes, and finance programs, allowing historical polluters to ramp up global fossil fuel production, will only intensify the climate emergency. The consequences of COP26 are dire and will impact the survival of Indigenous peoples and local communities across the planet. While doing little to reduce global greenhouse gas emissions at source, many communities around the world do not have time." End quote by Tom Goldtooth. That was an excerpt from the November 13, 2021 press release by the Indigenous Environmental Network on what they call the disastrous outcome of the COP26 in Glasgow. Now back to September 2021 in New York City for an impression of the goals and strength and international connections of a movement that has already opposed these false solutions. Leonardo Figueroa Gelin is associate professor and chair of the Environmental Policy and Sustainability Management Program at the New School. He is part of his welcome.
It is truly an honor and a pleasure to be here with you. I speak to you from the lands of the Lenape in Lenape Hawking, the ancestral and unceded lands of the Lenape. My name is Leonardo Figueroa Gelin. Originally from Mesoamerica, I'm an arrivant in Lenape Hawking, currently in so-called New Jersey. And it's truly, truly an honor and a pleasure to be joined by this distinguished panel of speakers. With that, I'd like to pass the floor to Ananda.
And here's a quick insert about Ananda. Ananda Tan is North America Coordinator for the Global Alliance for Incinerator Alternatives. Gaia is a worldwide alliance of more than 800 grassroots groups, non-governmental organizations, and individuals in over 90 countries. Their ultimate vision is a just, toxic-free world without incineration.
Thanks, everyone who's been able to join. It's truly an honor for me to be the moderator on a panel of not only such amazing, inspiring organizers and movement leaders, but also people I consider family, people who are my people, who we've been working together for many years now, mentors, peers, young leadership that is coming up, and I'll introduce them a bit more in detail, but I'll start off with some of the context that I agreed to provide in the lead into this conversation and this moment. And I'll ask our panelists to reflect on this later. Why should we be concerned? You know, what's really happening? How are we being hoodwinked in the hothouse? Just to note that this is a third edition of Hoodwinked. It was a collaboration for the first two editions. The last edition that I know at least Tom and I worked on, possibly a number of you worked on, and many others on this call, was produced in the lead up to the Copenhagen Climate Conference in 2009. And at that time, it was very important because in many countries, starting with the US, the UN's Kyoto Protocol had started driving domestic legislation towards carbon market mechanisms, the idea that we could, through pricing pollution and creating opportunities for the world's largest polluters to then come up with ways in which to reduce greenhouse gas emissions through market-based mechanisms and technology investments, that we could address the climate crises, that we started to really actively coordinate and a response, you know, a popular education response to really inquiring why these technocratic neoliberal policy options were really problematic. And it has a longer history that I'll ask our brother Tom to reflect on later, but it really goes back to the inception of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change in the first place, of how such a assembly, the League of Nations, you know, for many of us in this day and age are starting to recognize that it remains an incomplete assembly because it actually does not include the oldest living nations, you know, of this earth, all the indigenous communities that live around the earth and that can really provide us guidance in this moment of ecological crises are not at the table as full participants. How can the League of Nations or the UN itself be take on the responsibility to provide this global strategy? It needs to be called into question. But underneath that, what has been advanced, starting with the Kyoto Protocol, which was really the world's first carbon market mechanism. And if for some of you veterans, you may remember that Al Gore only, the US delegation only agreed to signing Kyoto call after it centered a carbon market mechanism, the Clean Development Mechanism, which then for many years afterwards served to subsidize massive problematic polluting industries and frontline communities around the world, with landfill gas and incinerator projects in places like India and Brazil, to landfill, you know, displacement of workers, to the displacement of indigenous peoples from their lands, to forest carbon offsets regimes, to a whole host of other frontline community impacts. This clean development mechanism really set us up to actually move in the wrong direction. You know, it ended up being probably the world's largest, what we call these days, perverse subsidies, policy subsidies for those destroying the earth. In that context, and since then, there's been a whole host of other institutions in the US, namely the California Global Warming Solutions Act, which produced the California Carbon Trading Mechanism, and various other voluntary trading mechanisms, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative on the East Coast of the United States, and a whole host of other carbon market mechanisms around the world that really, in many of our views, subsidize the polluters to actually add more burden on primarily frontline communities, primarily indigenous, Black, Brown, migrant, and poor communities who are already suffering the worst impacts of climate change. Those on the front lines of the fires, the droughts, the storms, the floods, but also on the front lines of the toxic pollution burdens, of the police and prison industrial complex violence that maintain the hegemony of these corporate polluters, and a whole other series of systems of violence that have oppressed primarily indigenous and people of color and poor communities around the world. So in that context, it's more germane than ever that we continue fighting this agenda, this corporate agenda, to hijack harm, to opportunistically try to profiteer off the suffering of millions around the world, and further entrench the systemic racism, the systemic patriarchy, the systemic violence that's levied at the communities that we organize in. And so in that context, what today we're hoping to do is really give you a sort of a more detailed examination of how that agenda has prevailed, has continued from the Paris Agreement to the current day negotiations, and how through the implementation of the Paris Agreement in the at the upcoming, or the negotiations about the implementation of the agreement that are going to take place in Scotland, in Glasgow at COP26, how some of those threads have actually, you know, threatened to take us in the direction we cannot afford to go. In this time of Anthropocene, in this time of recognizing we humanity has created the largest ecological crisis, the sixth great extinction, some are calling it, that there are some, you know, amongst us who actually shoulder the major burden of responsibility for driving this crisis. Those that are making billions of dollars at the expense of others, as we've seen through this pandemic, but also those who still continue to have the most influence in government, those who are driving the Biden administration to now look at options like carbon capture and sequestration and further entrench nuclear power and waste at the cost of people's lives. Those institutions are now at the table, you know, realizing the fact that those who are destroying the planet and those who are profiting most from it are going to have the front and center position in deciding what the global compact is going to do in the coming years. This is something that requires not only a deep systemic challenge or a challenge of the deep systemic inequities, but really a clear understanding across our movements, across all the environmental groups that are advocating and organizing for climate change, that are trying to find new streams of funding and trying to create philanthropic support for these movements, of folks who are working on policy, for folks who are fighting climate change and building the resilience of their communities on the ground. It requires a coordinated effort and a shared understanding of how we navigate this problem, how we tear these policy tables away from some of these neoliberal policy pathways and agendas and actually move towards the solutions we need. But without further ado, I'll actually introduce my colleagues, and whom it's a pleasure to have Jackie, Ariel, Monieka, and Tom here. I'll start with Tom because, in my culture, acknowledging our elders and those who have provided us mentorship is key. And Tom is someone I've had, there's very few people I kind of openly call a mentor, but Tom is someone I've learned from over the years, over the decades, his wisdom, his foresight, but also his persistence at principle practice. Tom is someone who's always reminded me that we need to be inclusive of everyone, especially those voices who are not represented. And as a veteran environmental justice organizer, pointed us to those principles of really centering the voices of those first and most impacted, and next ensuring that nobody is excluded. In early days of forming the Climate Justice Alliance or at other environmental justice initiatives, Tom has always raised the fact that we shouldn't forget our poor white brothers and sisters in Appalachia, or those working class communities, just because they're white communities, we should make sure to an extra effort to sometimes include them when we have our EJ gatherings, or making sure that we have balance that community, not just the NGOs with privilege, but also those without paid staff are included. This is something that for me has provided really important guidance. So Tom, thank you for joining us. And I wondered if you would share some opening reflections on the relevance of Hoodwinked and this examination of corporate false solutions today.
Sure. Thank you, Ananda. You did a really good introduction on Hoodwinked. And as you were talking, I was thinking about the 26 years that have gone by since the United Nations Earth Summit back in 1992, that it adopted the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change as a process for the world governments to come together to address climate change. So here we are. It's been a long road. I got involved in 1998, coming out of a Native-based summit in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and got mandates from there from traditional people, spiritual leaders, women's societies, youth, and some of our tribal governments programs that were concerned about climate change. And we sent a document that is our mandate and has been something that we've built upon as we started to participate in these climate meetings. And I remember when Orrin Lyons is one of our elders and faith keepers from the Haudenosaunee Confederacy out east of me, he said within their confederacy, they prophesized that the time will come when the trees start dying from the top down. So they translated that into the change in climate and said that we need to get involved as Indigenous peoples. So since that time, I like to report that there's been a lot of successes, and there have been some of that. But, as far as industrialized countries of the North who have played a lot of power politics in the negotiations, the amount of emission reductions, just it has not ever been met. The Kyoto Protocol you mentioned that was signed in 1997, that was very moderate. In a way, once I got familiar with the greenhouse effect and that, it wasn't even near to where we needed to get. But during the 26 years going to the COP, emissions from fossil fuels, from the burning of fossil fuels and the mining, the extraction of fossil fuels, it continues to rise, especially in the industrialized countries that share the main responsibility for the increase in atmospheric emissions. And that's why, for us in our movement as Indigenous peoples, we started to come together with the Global South and the Black and people of color and poor communities in this country, but also in the Global South, around looking at the issues around who is responsible for addressing this issue, who has contributed the most and created this climate debt, you could say, ecosystems debt. Also looking at economic justice and economic debt that is very critical. So since then, we all have said, I think it's not new to the listening audience, that when we say that the UN meeting has been taken over by the corporations, we realize that it's been more about negotiations of business more than regulation. Breakdown of the road to the 2015 Paris Agreement as part of the UN climate meetings. But from I need to say, from our Indigenous environmental network and standing with the analysis of our brothers and sisters from the South, we say that the result of this UN Paris Agreement is that it's a trade agreement. It's nothing more. It's not a climate agreement. It's a trade agreement. It promises to privatize, to commodify, and to sell forested lands as carbon offsets, proving a financial laundering mechanism for rich developed countries and the corporations, the polluting corporations of the North, to launder their carbon pollution on the backs of the Global South and in the North on the backs of our Indigenous Black and people of color and low-income communities. We know this, but it's surprising that a lot of the general society, the public in the North, Canada, United States, and civil society throughout the world haven't put that together. That's why it was very important for us to come together and to produce the third version of this hoodwinked in the hothouse publication with the goal to demystify carbon markets, carbon pricing, geoengineering technologies, and extreme energy developments, such as mega hydro dams, for an example, nuclear energy. And there's a lot of other forms of energy that's being proposed that is not clean and it's destructive. So we've seen a dangerous slide since our participation, since I've been going into the hallways of these UN climate meetings. it's a slide towards a lawless capitalism. I like to say it isn't, but it's where this free market ideology, neoliberalism, is privatizing every aspect of our lives, and virtually there's no public oversight to this, no accountability of their profiteering. That's how serious this issue is, and why we found as Indigenous peoples that we need to wake up the world. Somehow the world has lost that relationship to the sacredness of Mother Earth and Father Sky, and that we feel that Mother Earth is not for sale. The sky is not for sale. So part of the politics around climate change that we're seeing here domestically in the United States, including our sisters to have to deal with the same politics in Canada, we have used the word disaster capitalism, tied with the short-sightedness of carbon and techno-fundamentalism that's driving this corporate false promises. And I wanted to just share a couple of these thoughts with you to start out this discussion. And even the flooding of big money from philanthropic capitalists such as Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and Elon Musk, who are pushing false solutions, especially within geoengineering technologies such as carbon capture and storage and solar radiation management. So how do we convey this to our young people, to society, so that they can become aware of what's really happening when we talk about climate policy and how to mitigate and adapt to a changing climate? Our concern, for an example, with these funders, they sourced up to a tune of $100 million, some of the major NGOs that are fighting us when we speak the truth on how these false solutions do not cut admissions at the source that we need. So we ask you to download, to get a copy of Hoodwinked, and you'll see a whole package of exposures of this climate investment schemes. And it is like Ananda said, it's designed to reward the profiteers, who are the very folks that are causing the problem and the pollution. And I want to say, related to our traditional knowledge, is that at least those people that have guided me says, when I explain this whole process of the carbon offsets, for an example, carbon markets, cap and trade, carbon tax, I explained it and break it down to a lot of spiritual leaderships, not only in the North, but in the South. And they say, it's not right. How can we put a price to the air? How can we include the air like carbon and methane and greenhouse gases into a modern market system and treat it as a commodity? So it's a legal system of privatization. Mm-hmm. And for any of our folks that want to participate in these systems, I asked the question, how do you reconcile participation in these false solutions that commodify and privatizes Mother Earth and nature? We've started to work on one area way back in the early 2000s on reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation. It was a carbon offset initiative that still is continuing, called RED. It's where in polluting industry like, for an example, Chevron or Shell, who pollute in California, they can offset their pollution locally by going carbon neutral, buying carbon credits to protect the trees in the Amazon. Sure, we want to do everything we can to protect the trees of our brothers and sisters, but in these false solutions, using trees as carbon sponges, as scams that really allow the polluters to continue to pollute in the North, creating toxic hotspots. That's wrong. That's wrong. So now we're seeing a rebranding of the organizing that we did amongst many different organizations throughout the world to expose, like, RED as being a scam. They rebranded it Now it's called Nature-Based Solutions. Nature-Based Solutions. And my other final comment on these is that we're very cautious on Green New Deal governmental initiatives as being part of green economy scams. So these are where we have to be alert. We got to have the capacity to really look through these smoke screens and speak out, such again as nature-based solutions or natural climate solutions, and using terms such as regenerative agriculture. Check these out, where they're using soil now and the carbon in the soil. But whose money is that? That money comes from the polluters again as an offset for their pollution. So this is where we want to share this information with you. The Hoodwink booklet is very, very helpful towards that. And this whole process that's taken place and this worldview, how the world uses machines to make meaning of life, where Mother Earth is objectified like the objectification of woman and treated like a machine made of parts that can be replaced, redesigned, or engineered. That's where we're at. That's really where we're at in this world, where DNA is coded to be edited and deleted. At what point? At the whims of the corporations, where our bodies and engines and food is fuel, where the world is not seen as a complex, interdependent, beautiful, and sacred relations. That's why within our culture, we say, Midakiye Owase, we are all related. And that's what I wanted to share with you. Hope this is helpful. The publication is very timely. The world is being promised that these false solutions addressing climate change will eradicate poverty and world hunger, empower our women, address environmental justice issues, and provide funding for just transition and help Indigenous peoples obtain land rights and guarantee our right to free, prior, and informed consent. This is not happening. This is a lie. It's a collection of conflicts, contradictions, and lies. Mother Earth is the source of life, which needs to be protected, not a resource to be exploited and commodified as natural capital. We only have one Mother Earth. Let's protect her. Thank you very much.
That was Tom Goldtooth. He's active on local, national, and international levels as an advocate for building healthy and sustainable Indigenous communities based on the foundation of Indigenous traditional knowledge. Tom Goldtooth has served as Executive Director of the Indigenous Environmental Network since 1996. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.